from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Amazon, Amazon.com, aims high and has climbed high. The online retailer is now the biggest retailer in the world. But a big New York Times expose has painted work life inside Amazon as a kind of nightmare, unrelenting, unforgiving, dog-eat-dog, heartless. If Amazon's a winner, is this the future? This hour on Point, Amazon and the future of work. The New York Times went hammer and tongs here inside Amazon, wrestling big ideas in a bruising workplace. There are plenty of examples where Amazon itself has said, yeah, this place isn't for everybody. Here's a little bit from an Amazon recruiting video posted in May on YouTube. Nimisha Sabu, an Amazon senior technical program manager, described what it's like to work at Amazon.
It's absolutely different working for Amazon as compared to working for another company. You either fit here or you don't. You love it or you don't. There is, you know, no middle ground, really.
You fit here or you don't. You love it or you don't. There's no middle ground, and that's sure the way it read in the Times piece. CEO, founder Jeff Bezos himself received the Liberty Science Center Genius Award in May. After receiving that award, he talked about Amazon's mission, and it is very ambitious. Here's Bezos.
Our mission has always been to be Earth's most customer-centric company. And by that I mean customer-obsessed instead of competitor-obsessed. And that is, sometimes we hire new employees at Amazon, and they come from a different kind of corporate culture, and they're a little bored because we don't wake up every morning with a competitive zeal to kill somebody else. We're more of explorers, and we kind of invent new ways, and we do wild things. A lot of them don't work.
Well, what about the way they work? Does that work? Amazon has come forward and said, look, this just can't be right the way this is described. Their senior VP for Global Corporate Affairs is former White House Press Secretary Jay Carney. He was on CBS This Morning defending Amazon, disputed the story, called Amazon an incredibly compelling place to work. Compelling.
The fundamental flaw in the story is the suggestion that any company that had the kind of culture that the New York Times wrote about and sort of a cruel Darwinian or Dickensian kind of atmosphere in the workplace could survive and thrive in today's marketplace.
If it was bad as all that, it could not survive and thrive. Well, it's created an enormous stir. Let's look at it. Joining me from Washington is Ezra Klein. He's editor-in-chief of Vox.com. He parses the New York Times expose on Amazon in a Vox explainer headlined, Why the New York Times Amazon Story is So Controversial. You can link to that at our website and the original big piece at onpointradio.org. Ezra Klein, welcome back to On Point. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So is the controversy here because the Times didn't get it right, or because they said they interviewed more than 100 people at Amazon, or because they got it right and people are thinking, oh my God, this is the future of work?
I think one of the things you learn as a journalist is there are a lot of ways to get things right that don't quite tell the full story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you have right now in the debate between the Times and the authors of the story, and this is, by the way, a great piece of journalism, people should read it, is a debate between sort of different aspects of Amazon that are all true simultaneously. So the Times story, I don't think, paints a Dickensian portrait of Amazon. What it paints...
Not Dickensian? I mean, it describes people... It says nearly every person I worked with, I saw cry at their desk. You walk out of a conference room, you see a grown man covering his face. I don't know. Sounds Dickensian,
yeah,
though.
True. You got to be careful with that kind of thing, though. I mean, I'm applying a certain filter to this, which
okay.
is that when you read an anecdote in a news story, you should not confuse that with data. I think the Times paints a very clear picture of a place that is highly, highly competitive, highly intense, that expects tremendous work hours, and that has pockets in the company where some terrible things have happened. At the same time, you need to be careful not to let the worst moments of a company completely define it. And I think when you look at the backlash to the story written by people who currently do or previously have worked at Amazon, you see that too. You see people talking about moments of incredible generosity from the company. You hear people saying, I've never seen anybody cry. You hear managers saying, if I ever heard of one of my managers treating employees like this, I would fire them. You see Jeff Bezos writing a letter saying, you know, if we treat people callously, that needs to be reported to HR. That's not acceptable.
He wrote that in the aftermath of this piece. Yeah.
Yes. What I think is interesting in this, though, is that the truth is Amazon and its critics agree on a lot more here than I think people are letting on. Amazon drives people incredibly, incredibly hard. And if you love the work, and if you're great at the work, and if you are happy to work sort of very long hours for a very, very, by the way, lavish level of compensation, then it's going to work out great for you. And if you're not, if you don't want to work those hours, if you don't love the work, if maybe the work is not something you're incredibly sort of best of class good at, they're going to make your life miserable until you leave. And what I think is important to remember here is that the people we're talking about are highly skilled white-collar workers who have other options. And I just have trouble worrying so much about that particular class. Now, Amazon does have all of these workers who work in warehouses, this huge blue-collar force that is loading these boxes, packing these boxes. They're often hired not by Amazon directly, but through contractors.
And we have talked about those with ambulances, the scandalous ambulances outside these un-air-conditioned warehouses to take them off to the hospital as they collapse with unbelievable demands on them crawling all over to retrieve those products and get them shipped out fast. But when we talked, that was a couple of years ago that came out. We talked about it on the show. I guess I kind of assumed that that was, you know, brutal taskmaster for the low-paid warehouse people, but that back at headquarters it would be a little different. And what strikes me here, Ezra, that same, zeitgeist seems to go right all the way up through Amazon. And yes, you can look at anecdote, but it seems to me that what's got people's attention here in part is Amazon is now the world's biggest retailer. That means it is a trendsetter. It is a path blazer. If this is the way things work at Amazon, not just anecdotally, but there's systematic things that they've implemented here, might that become the way of work in this country? As the Times puts it, nimble and more productive, but also harsher and less forgiving.
I think the blue-collar piece of this is important, and I think it gets to exactly what you're asking about here. I know a number of people who work at Amazon, and I've been following this debate pretty closely. Mm-hmm. And I think that Amazon is, like a lot of companies, a place where work and pressure, where good and bad management are unevenly distributed. I think some people work incredibly long hours and have terrible bosses who are callous about maternity, callous about sickness, callous about family responsibilities. And I think other people at Amazon work much more reasonable hours. And I'm talking here about white-collar workers in the headquarters. Work much more reasonable hours, have great bosses, love their jobs. And what will happen in a story like this, and it's no fault of the reporters, is that the people who are going to be most interested in talking and the people whose stories are going to be the most vivid are the people who had something terrible happen. I mean, that is how, to some degree, journalism just often works.
You're going back to the anecdote charge there.
I want to be super clear. That doesn't make it untrue.
Also, that continues the anecdotal characterization of this, but I think it's important to look that there are confirmed processes also here that the Times is kind of calling out. You know, one, all team members are ranked every year, and the bottom of those are eliminated or fired every year. Now, there's up or out is something that goes on in many parts of government and private industry. But what about that just as a structure? They know that every year the bottom-ranked people are going to be gone, and they describe a lot of sniping and backbiting and even conspiring against some people that goes on so that, you know, you and I may decide to report badly on somebody else so that they go out and not us.
So two things on that. One is that there's been a lot of dispute of that characterization. And the truth is, I just don't know the answer there. There are a number of managers in Amazon who say, that is just not how this process works. It's never been how it worked. We wouldn't participate in it if it did. I can't adjudicate that, but I want to put it out there because I can't adjudicate it. But
they're pretty clear on reporting it, I must say, but okay.
Sorry?
They're pretty clear on reporting it, I have to say.
I just can't. Yeah. I can't say who's right in that. I just don't have data on that. But what I think I can say, and it speaks to something you just said, up or out and these kinds of rankings, they're common not just in the tech industry, but they're common on Wall Street. They're common in management consulting. They're common in a lot of
military,
high pressure, high compensation, white-collar industries. And so that's one of the things you were saying a second ago, that why this has struck such nerves is this question of, is this the future of white-collar work? Well, I think to some degree it's also the past. I mean, a lot of the things that were sort of deeper in the piece about that level of pressure didn't feel that new to me. I mean, I know people who work on Wall Street, which before, you know, all the sort of young Harvard graduates who want to make a lot of money were going to Silicon Valley. They were going to Wall Street. And the stories you hear out of that were, frankly, even more brutal. And so I just am not sure that what is happening at Amazon is, one, all that different. But I think this is an important point. It's something related to what Carney was saying. It also just isn't something that worries me that much. So I run a media organization, and you know, we are competing for technological talent. We're competing for editorial talent.
Yep.
And if I make a workplace where my people are not happy, they're in demand and they'll leave. And that exerts a natural check on the system. If you are at Amazon and you are a high performer and they are treating you badly or they are asking things of you that do not allow you to have a family life, you're going to go to Google because Google is pretty good about family life. And that absolutely happens, by the way. And so a system where you have the capacity to exit and have another good job is a system that can only get on some level so brutal. And that's why it's very different, in my view, than what happens in the Amazon warehouses, where these are warehouses in rural areas with very few jobs, and the people do not have other options. And so it's just hard for me on some fundamental level to get that concerned about the Amazon employees who are there by choice in Seattle and have other job options if they are in a portion of Amazon that really is that bad.
You're tough,
to
boss. You're
the
tough.
Amount of
conference calls on Easter Sunday and Thanksgiving, you know, make sure you've got internet on vacation, hours working at nights and weekends. But I guess you're the boss at Vox.com, so you want that too.
No, I don't. I actually would not want any of my employees working on holidays like that because they're going to leave. This is, I think, an important point, and it shouldn't be missed. And it's one reason I think it's complicated, and this is something people on Amazon who have not had that experience are saying as well, that that's a really bad way to manage people. They're going to leave. Let's say you've got a great 25-year-old employee, and they get married, and then 3 years later, they have a child, and you're making them work nights on weekends. You're making them not have...
They'll be gone. As we're up against the clock, my friend, I appreciate you joining us from Vox.com.
To leave.
We're talking Amazon and workplace policy. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the work culture at Amazon, as in Amazon.com. Reportedly, New York Times says, brutal, dog-eat-dog, relentless, unforgiving. We already heard Amazon ranking people. They're saying, look, it's not for everybody working here. Our friend Ezra Klein at Vox.com says, if it's really that bad, they can leave. It can be tough in there, and people wonder where does this go? There's a 2014 CNBC documentary called Amazon Rising. Former Amazon executives John Rossman and Randy Miller here in this bit of tape describe Jeff Bezos, Amazon's founder, approach to managing the company.
He has a low tolerance for thinking small, acting small, or not being extremely sharp.
Or rationalizing. If you start giving rationalizations and excuses...
Or pointing the other direction.
He'll just... He'll slash you to shreds. He's got a very effective, sarcastic bent.
He will slash you to shreds. Jay Carney for Amazon says, come on, if we were this bad, this Dickensian, we wouldn't be successful. We wouldn't be around. But the report is deep. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. We've got big thinkers on this. I want to bring them in, but a couple of callers first, because experience counts here. Glenn in Laverne, Tennessee. Glenn, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and guests. Yes, I'm an over-the-road truck driver, and I've worked in several warehouses in this area. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to call any names, but I also make deliveries and pick up at different warehouses.
Okay.
And I think it's disturbing to see that even on Sundays, that 18 to 25 or 35-year-olds from all different countries, are even on Sundays, mm-hmm. are in these warehouses and demand that's put upon them to be there at work, working on a Sunday as if it were a regular work day.
So no day of rest, Glenn. No day of rest in the warehouse business.
That's what I see. And they're in there like it's a regular work day. And no family time. That takes away from their time with their family. More and more women in the workplace, so they're not at home where... And I don't think they have to be all the time, but I mean, it is disturbing. And I think it's the trend. The demand is so high on the worker now for us to be globally competitive or to make profits for CEOs. Warehouses are more centralized.
Yeah. But you know, Glenn, Amazon is famous for its like turbocharged warehouses that are cranking things out. They want to be able to deliver you a product you order online sometimes within hours. I mean, could it be that you say it's global competition? Maybe it's Amazon itself. Yes, it's winning, but at what cost?
Also, I worked for a pharmaceutical company, and they could get things across the nation overnight to any state in this country. The demand that it put up on the worker was
yeah,
astounding.
Glenn, I appreciate your call very much. Truck driver there who sees it all, it can feel pretty miraculous when that product shows up the next day. Amazon definitely is making all kinds of breakthroughs in customer service, as Bezos says. What does that mean on the work side, the human side of the equation? Jay in Akron, Ohio. Jay, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom. I guess, the thing is, I worked in a variety of white-collar jobs, and the thing is that if you have a performance review, it's the Glengarry Ross mentality. It's cannibalization. You have to get to the top, and you have to prove with as many hours and as overdoing the going way above and beyond on the work to make sure that you're the best in that group. It's not really even about the team anymore. You know, everybody kind of cannibalizes each other until there's one person at the bottom and then there's definitely somebody at the top. That's just how it is.
How do you feel about that, Jay? Is it naive to expect anything else these days, or is there still some space in which to say, wait a minute, this is inhumane?
I think it's naive. I mean, when we hear the stuff that's going on at Apple, with product manufacture and just invention overall, everybody's trying to come up with the top idea. Everybody's trying to come up with new technologies or a way to do a process faster or automate. And the thing about it is that somebody's going to come up with that idea first. That company will push you harder and harder until somebody pumps that idea out. So, to think that you're going to work in a company nowadays where it's just going to be, hey, we work together and, everybody's getting to the same place at the same time. That's just not where we are in this century,
Wow. Get over it, you say, in a way. It can feel like a lot to get over, but we're in the 21st century, as you say, Jay. I appreciate your call as well. I want to bring in a couple of good thinkers on this front. With us first from Silicon Valley, San Jose, Jan English Lewick is with us, professor of anthropology at San Jose State, and she's been following work and work culture in Silicon Valley for a long time. She developed the Silicon Valley Cultures Project, a study on people and communities whose lives are connected there, author of Being and Well-Being, Health and the Working Bodies of Silicon Valley. Jan English Lewick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And from Ithaca, New York, Robert Frank joins us, professor of management economics at Cornell. He is author of The Darwin Economy. Robert Frank, thank you for coming on.
Tom, nice to be back on.
Take us into this big-time story. I assume both of you saw it, read it. I wonder what you thought of it. It's presented as an expose. Were you agog at what you read here, Robert Frank? Is this just the world we live in? Is it an outrage? Is it portend something, intimidating for our work futures, or is it just the way things are?
Well, I think a lot of the specific anecdotes that the story related were scary. I think, as Ezra Klein pointed out, though, if that were a pervasive description of the culture, many more people would be leaving than seem to be. But I think the deeper point is that in a company, you mentioned they're the biggest retailer in the world now, a slight difference in the quality of an employee's performance translates into a huge number on the company's bottom line. If you're just 1% better than the next best person who could have done the job you're doing, that's tens, hundreds of millions of dollars on the company's bottom line. And so you're worth so much in those jobs, and the company has very strong incentives to fill them with the very most talented people they can get. And so it's inevitable in job settings like that that there will be a pretty brutally competitive tournament to see who gets to fill those positions. Ezra mentioned that it's common in high-paid white-collar industries like law firms and investment banking firms, this up-or-out system. It's also common in other domains where the jobs are really highly sought after. I've got a great job. I'm a tenured professor at a great university. There aren't many slots like that to have. And so there's an up or out system. You know, they hired a bunch of people, and then it was a competition to see who got promoted. Only a small fraction of us were lucky enough to make the cut. And in a situation like that, you don't need a boss standing over you cracking a whip. People, my colleagues, they worked on weekends. They worked long into the night. If the job is attractive enough, and these jobs pay so enormously that there are going to be many more people wanting to hold them, all of them good, it's natural that the company is going to want to see who's going to be the best person to fill that slot with. You can't tell just by interviewing, and so it's hard to envision a system where there wouldn't be some kind of term like that in a winner-take-all market. You hire a bunch of people, and then you see who ends up performing best over some span of time, and you retain the handful that do.
And we're all looking into the Petri dish through the prism of this piece now. Jan English-Lewick there in San Jose. Of course, Amazon is up in Seattle. You're in Silicon Valley. One of the things that this brought to mind was, you know, the descriptions of work in Silicon Valley often focus on, you know, foosball tables and lots of fun and Nerf footballs being thrown around and wonderful Google buffets put out to keep people happy and all kinds of actually very sort of cosseting HR policies that make life fun, I guess, and easier for staff. But Amazon was portrayed here as sort of tough, where Silicon Valley is often portrayed as luxurious, very accommodating workplace policies. Is it possible that there are two so different cultures, just north and south on that coast?
Well, I think, first of all, the Amazon culture isn't one culture. It's multiple cultures. And so Ezra's point that you're actually seeing that not only is the original article correct, so are the people responding to it, because they're living slightly different realities of that really relatively large organization.
Yeah, but nobody here is talking about the sort of famous Google-style stories of lavish buffets laid on. That's not here. Their policy don't go there.
Absolutely. Their policy is not to provide that kind of really intense corporate care. But at the same time, you did have responses to the original story that talked about foosball and fun and kind of bringing in that tech culture. And I think it's really important to understand that when people are recruited into any company, they're immigrants from another work experience, and they're bringing some of the expectations of their old position into the new position. Corporate culture is strong, but it doesn't wipe out people's work history. So you do get a little bit of the fun that people imported from other places into Amazon, but that isn't the whole story. And fun isn't the whole story in Silicon Valley. I mean, the narrative of being best in class, world class, it's a very aggressive narrative that people have internalized. And so even if you don't have a policy that you have to work vacations, weekends, evenings, you may drive yourself to it in your local work experience because the people around you and your team expect that. And so some of the stories that I was reading about from Amazon seem very familiar, that they were part of some of the experience of people who have worked in Silicon Valley, that same intense expectation that you will perform or you're out. And one of the things that's really struck me about that story, the original story, is one of the our work culture in the United States, there's a sort of sacred area of if you're sick, that's your pass. And that's something that was violated in that Amazon experience because you didn't get a pass.
People with cancer,
you didn't get
no mercy. People with the losing pregnancies, get to work, get back on the road. Is that weird?
I think that that's actually become much more normal. In the middle class office work experience, that your body is not the excuse it used to be. I mean, most of labor rights was about recognizing that people had bodies and families and lives, and that is eroding. And that's eroding not so much because of corporate policy, but because of the practices and the reality of that intense competition, the competition that Robert just referenced.
Rubber Frank, if your body is no longer, you've got cancer, but and you have to be treated for it, but that's no pass. That's no excuse. You should be performing just like anybody else, be performing at the best. I mean, surely there is some point at which humanity has to come into play here. Or is that going away? I mean, that's sort of what we're probing for here. Is that just an old middle-class expectation from the heyday of the American golden economy, and we can't afford the things that the sort of basic things that were fought for in the labor rights era anymore?
No, there's no issue at all of being able to afford basic rights like that. We're richer than we've ever been. We can afford more rights than we used to have. And I think there's not really any practical worry that we're going to see a lot of stage four cancer cases being prodded to go back to work.
But here we are reading about it at Amazon, the biggest retailer in the world. That's a big employer.
Well, I do know of cases in my own not-so-highly-paid arena where people who are ill nonetheless push themselves because they feel competitive pressure to perform. As one of the earlier callers said, somebody's going to come up with that idea first. And so if you lose ground relative to the people who you're competing with for a scarce slot, people will push themselves in ways they haven't before. You were wondering, is this the future of work? I think technically we do see a tendency to move in this direction just because software is invading every domain in the economy. It's going to produce more and more markets where the entry that's a little bit better than the rest can essentially serve the entire market, and that's just a huge payoff.
Sort of winner-take-all dynamic.
A winner-take-all market is going to drive people to compete more and more for these scarce slots because the rewards are so high.
Lewis, in
there
Clarksville,
are things
Tennessee.
We can do, but mm-hmm. it's difficult.
Lewis, calling in from Clarksville, Tennessee. Lewis, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just had a quick comment. It was really in response to Mr. Carney's assertion earlier that a Dickensian workplace couldn't thrive in today's America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the most outrageous thing from that article, which I read, was the Amazon's practice in Pennsylvania. So we're going along Glenn's line, pushing warehouse workers.
Yes.
Instead of paying for AC, they just decided to station an ambulance outside the door and just let them drop and then cart them out, you know, when they passed out from heat exhaustion. I think that's sort of, you know, gets to the heart of the story there, is that I think Amazon's doing what all the other retailers are doing. They're just pushing it a little further now.
In fairness, they have changed that policy now. They have air conditioning now, but not until after there was another earlier expose with photographs of the ambulances standing by for the, and it's not funny, overheated workers who were dropping inside to be taken to hospital. An extension of retail push here. Lewis, we've got it. Richard in Miami. Richard, thank you for calling. What do you think?
Yeah, hi, Tom. My comments are mainly directed toward the white collar and not the workforce.
Okay.
Because the workforce I have sympathy for. I have no sympathy or empathy for the white collar who are complaining because they might have to take a call on their vacation or something like that. I haven't had a job since 1976. I've been self-employed. And when you're self-employed, you do whatever it takes. You talk on the weekend, you talk on vacations, you find a phone somewhere, and you produce. Because if you don't produce, you don't eat. They're caged animals. But the point is if you press hard, there's a fine line. And you press them too hard and you're too insensitive to their needs, their personal needs, they'll shut down on you. You have to be able to let them go back and recuperate. You have to say, take a break. When I have a crew that's working, I say, all right, we've done it. I push them really hard. We work really long hours. And I go, go home. Go home and come back tomorrow. Because if you don't do that, you make them come go sleep on the job site and come back, they won't be fresh. They won't be new. They can't think new. They're going to be late. They're going to be sloppy. They're going to be careless.
Richard, let me ask you, Richard, does the fact that Amazon is winning, it's now bigger than Walmart, does that mean that they have not pushed too hard somehow?
That they have not pressed too hard?
Yeah, because they're winning.
Well, they're winning, but you know, when you got disposable people that you can use up and then use more people as they come in, which America provides. I mean, this is America. We're the leader in the economy in the world because we do press hard.
Richard, we've got it. I appreciate your call from Miami. We're talking about the work culture at Amazon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the work culture at Amazon, as in Amazon.com. Lots of response online. Not everybody is sympathetic to the complaints here. Colleen says, I think our workforce, on Facebook, she writes, I think our workforce today is filled with crybabies with no work ethic. I'm a 45-year-old woman who works circles around the 20-something men. Marty says, compare Amazon's work atmosphere to Netflix, which recently started giving employees up to 1 year paid maternity and paternity leave. Marty writes, when will employers realize that a happy employee who feels valued and respected is much more productive and loyal than employees undervalued and treated as disposable? Carrie says, Jeff Bezos runs a warehouse like a concentration camp trying to be a cheap overnight Santa. Okay. And SC says, as millennials make up a larger portion of the workforce, the alleged work environment of Amazon won't be sustainable long term, but they will be used to those cheap overnight products coming in. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I want to bring one more voice into our conversation. Clay Parker Jones joins us now, independent organizational design consultant, organizational design based in New York. Clay Parker Jones, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
So you talk with companies all the time about, you know, getting the way they work right. When you looked into this, read this expose, does it look to you like Amazon got something wrong?
I think certainly you see some individual anecdotes, just to go back to the point that Ezra made earlier, individual anecdotes that do signal something awry, you know, but I think that might be a little bit more of an individual problem rather than a policy problem. Because I think a lot of what Amazon's got going on, and if you read that article sort of dispassionately, you'll note that there's a lot of really great stories in there about individual achievement and the ability for really talented workers to do something great within the organization.
Okay, fair enough. But when they say, everybody I know cries at their desk, that doesn't sound so fun.
And sure. Well, I don't know that we want work to be fun necessarily.
Okay. That doesn't sound so tolerable.
Sure, sure. And I'll agree with you there. I think that the way that they've pushed their white-collar workers in particular, as is the focus of the article, has been remarkable for organizations in general. But I think you see this as several of the folks on the mm-hmm. line and earlier in the program have mentioned. This is pretty normal. There are organizations that ask a lot of their individual employees, and they get a lot because ideally we're the best organizations out there providing really incredible, interesting problems for people to solve that they can't find anywhere else.
I mean, this focuses on white collar. We should stipulate that blue collar have had it even worse. I mean, they're fainting and being taken off in ambulances from the warehouse when the expose came out there. So
absolutely.
I suppose that's worse. I don't know. You're a consultant in this area, so maybe you have to say nice things here because you want companies like Amazon to hire you.
Sure. I do have some economic benefit to being a fair and impartial person in this debate. But I think, the individual stuff that you're talking about with, folks in a warehouse fainting as a result of not employing air conditioning and lining up the ambulances outside to cart them off, that's reprehensible behavior. I don't think we can allow that in the workplace, and I think we have to have regulations certainly in place or put into place at least after the fact that prevent that kind of thing from happening. But a lot of what you're seeing in Amazon is sort of the best in class kind of policies, except for, you know, perhaps their paternity leave, their maternity leave, some of the other health related practices that have been pointed out and probably will need to change over time. But you see a decentralized workforce where people have incredible autonomy over their work. You see an organization that's using software and platforms to scale their reach beyond the individual reach of the employees. You see a lot of really good stuff here. in the midst of some really, really terrible anecdotes that I think will drive Amazon to change, because perhaps they weren't seeing all of this stuff as in as bright a light as the New York Times put on the issues at play.
Best in class. It's kind of wild to read this story and then hear it described as best in class.
Absolutely. And I think what you see here is sort of a continuation on organizations trying to get more and more out of their employees. And when I say best in class, I don't mean most humane or most dignified. I think that's something that we have to start turning our mind to, because people, as mentioned earlier, as Robert Frank mentioned, they have incredible choice. They can go do other things. They can start other organizations that compete against Amazon, that have better policies. Netflix will steal away the workers from Amazon, and hopefully the market allows us to find the best policies that make organizations operate most effectively. And hopefully we can push Amazon as consumers, as advocates, as voices in the media, to change the way that they operate and make it more dignified, more humane to come to work while maintaining that high achievement culture that they've created.
I don't know about that. As consumers, we may be pushing them toward all kinds of mania because they want to deliver that product in 5 minutes after we hit the buy button online. Donna in
sure.
Toano, Virginia. Donna, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
You're quite welcome. Someone there in the debate said that an employee can just go somewhere else. I would like to hear someone comment on the non-compete clause that's in contracts that an employee signs. And essentially that means, the way I understand it, that this employee cannot work in a field like or similar to the one he already works in for 18 months. And that a worker can be sued if he does break the non-compete clause.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's see how far down that goes into an organization. Robert Frank, what about that? In the white-collar rank and file at Amazon, how deeply do you imagine that you'd find non-compete clauses at work that might actually inhibit people from taking off if they don't like the way things go?
I think those clauses are fairly widespread. What you need to understand about them, and I don't know anything specific about Amazon's, but they really try to prevent the employee from taking valuable information from the company and taking it and making use of it in the employ of a direct competitor. If you have a skill that makes you valuable, often that skill is valuable in many, many different settings. And so signing an agreement not to compete by going to another online retailer would not prohibit you from taking a job as an expert programmer or developer at some other business that's not directly competing with Amazon. So I don't think that's the core of the problem. And I think also it's important to remember that people care about their working conditions. You know, we look at salary first, probably. That's the most visible and easily compared feature of a job. But word gets out about working conditions. And we know that law firms in the past tried to compete for talented employees by offering special exemptions from the grueling workload. There were several that offered the so-called mommy track. There were really talented women graduating from Yale on law review who wouldn't consider employment at the blue chip law firms because they knew that the associates there worked 80-hour weeks. And so those firms offered a mommy track where you could work 30 hours a week. The employees were happy they took those jobs, but then the internal pressures to compete, many of the people who took those jobs reported that over time their weekly workload crept up to 40, then 50, then 60, 65 hours, maybe not up to 80 hours, but The origin of these changing conditions in the kinds of jobs you're talking about, Tom, really is the intense competition to get them because they're so desirable.
And no mommy track, at least the visible at Amazon. John in Louisville, Kentucky. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Quick comments from someone who is in one of those high dollars but works in the blue collar. I think two things, conversation. One, missing the pressure is capitalism won worldwide, and I'm going to tell you, I'm in a high-tech company in Silicon Valley and U.S.-based. The jobs, even my own and others directly below me that work for me, are going to offshore. So don't mistake that more and more white-collar jobs are going to places that work 24/7, and the work ethic and education levels and ability to compete is vastly different when you talk about that. So you got to understand that that's happening. And second, I think we are becoming a divided workplace. We talk about income inequality, but in fact, you're seeing more and more, you have white-collar, high-dollar leaders. And many times those people in what we would call blue collar are now a cost basis. Companies are looking to manage that at cost. And that means if they lose too many employees, they'll go do things to keep them, but it's about a cost business ratio. I don't think there's an employer compact that exists anymore. I think it's been broken.
So what does that mean? It's like the weather, just take it?
Capitalism won. Look, a lot of people don't like the fact that capitalism won across the world. That means cost and supply of labor matters. But capitalism has always been, here's where labor. Even our own country, people went north and south to jobs. I think we've forgotten that. And what's happening now is, as you said, your good point about we want that button fast and cheap.
Yep.
That means blue-collar labor, because of the labor pool, has become a cost basis. Companies look at labor below a certain level as not strategic. It is cost. That will drive many behaviors. Now, what happened in Amazon with some of the things you said? Reprehensible. But you talk to people. I have friends
who
work in poultry plants. They work in warehouses. My daughter in college worked at a Zappos warehouse, right? She succeeded really well, but she had to work like crazy. And it's all about, it's a cost basis. If you deliver value at that cost of labor, you're going to get done. It's the same in the fast food industry and other things we talk about. Labor is a cost. In the high dollar world, it's a produce. So you're going to get that high value, but you better show the value you're producing at that level. And your competition is now someone who may make significantly more and is willing to be up during the night U.S. hours and do your job.
Steve, John, I appreciate your call from Louisville and your experience there. And yes, there's competition all over the place. And still, we struggle with how to think about this. Alice in the Water writes to us on Twitter, I was once written up at a job for not answering my boss's emails that she sent at 2 a.m. while I was on vacation. I mean, is there a line? Is there a limit somewhere? Clay Parker-Jones, another thing that comes up here, we see in the newspapers just in the last couple of days, all the new monitoring software for white-collar jobs, people being tracked, their productivity being tracked all day and maybe all night, maybe 24 hours a day. In some ways, this is white-collar people getting accustomed to the sort of measurements that have put up against blue-collar work for a long time, Clay.
Yeah, I think we can do a lot better than just trying to monitor our way to high performance. I think Amazon has a lot of attributes that don't look necessarily like that. And to me, that is sort of the harbinger of the end of work being interesting. If we have to say, yes, we have to watch how many emails you put out, or I have to write you up if you don't respond to me after 2 a.m. For me, the transparency aspects and the motivational aspects that are inherent to a decentralized, autonomous workplace like Amazon need to be countered with a sense of humanity. And just adding software to track how productive we are isn't the best way to push complex laborers toward really, really high-achieving outputs. So to me, this is when we've gone too far is when we've started to track every single output in every single meeting and whenever we talk to somebody throughout the day.
But, Jan, it feels like that's what's coming. That's what's here. More and more, even white-collar tracking and monitoring of productivity software at work all the time.
I think you're absolutely spot on there. I think that is the reinvention of the management practices of performance is going to go from these sort of episodic, annual, monthly, weekly, to continuous tracking. The big question I think that we should be discussing is what is being tracked and what metrics are being used to judge you. Because if it is simply your keystrokes, and as a sole
that won't
metric
do.
Of
Angry Birds makes then, keystrokes. Yeah.
Then, it how do you then add some things that track stress, well-being, putting a few other things into that pile of metrics? And I do see some signs that in Silicon Valley companies, they're interested in having those tools to help people be more humane and have more balanced lives in addition to simply tracking productivity. And I think the comment about value is spot on. As long as you can be valuable, you will be supported. If you're not considered valuable, you will not be supported. And that is probably the future of work.
Boy, that knife can come down sharpened in a hurry here. Donald in Williamsburg, Virginia, our time is very short, Donald, but I want to get you on.
Hi. I heard earlier that you said Amazon had won. I was wondering if you could tell me what they won.
Well, they're the largest retailer in the world. They're bigger than Walmart now. So
they make absolutely no profit. They have $1 billion come in. They have $1 billion in costs. That may be for their senior management. And ultimately, that's the problem, because the power rests with them. And that's how they exploit workers. And that's ultimately the real problem. When you look at the power relationships in these companies, you see where it lies. And it's never with anyone who works for them.
Donald, I don't know how that works in a company where there's stock options all over the place. But certainly you're right. There's a lot of power at the top. Jeff Bezos has created a culture. He has driven a company to the top in terms of scale in his business, and he's not finished yet. Don't be callous. Don't put up with callousness, he said in a letter this week to his employees. We'll see where that goes. Really interesting reporting here. Clay Parker-Jones, thank you so much for joining us today from New York. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jan English-Lewick at San Jose State University in California. Thank you, Jan, for your insights.
Thank you.
And Robert Frank at Cornell University, author of The Darwin Economy. Thanks, Robert.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.